tell you about, well, I'm sorry about this delay. I don't know what's happening. I cannot hear you. So let me try to give the talk, even though I will not hear what you ask. Okay, this talk is about the quantum origin of cosmic structure and arena for quantum gravity phenomenology. The first thing I want to say is this is the only place that we know of where quantum and gravity phenomena are needed and required to really take into account what we do observe. It's the only place where we have actually observed something that requires both the quantum and gravitational theory to be simultaneously used. No other example of gravity with quantum has been observed. The famous experiments with neutrons, for instance, are experiments that really can be described completely by going to a local inertial frame, a locally free-falling frame, because they don't require curvature. And as we know, curvature is the only place where gravity resides. It's not in the Newtonian sense that we believe gravity, we understand gravity. And that is only where gravity, where curvature and quantum mechanics simultaneously are required. This is the only place. Well, of course, if you go to the second transparency, I will then tell you about the plan of the talk. The first thing I'm going to tell you is why the standard law, the standard explanation of these observations, is not completely satisfactory, has some shortcomings. Then I'm going to tell you that an extra element is required to really understand what's going on. And this extra element, we believe, could be tied to quantum gravity. After that, I'm going to show you how one can really start exploring the phenomenology by looking at the data and comparing it with the different scenarios for this quantum gravity phenomenon. Then I'm going to show you that one can actually test some ideas in a more detailed fashion. For example, the simple generalization of Penrose proposal for the collapse of the wave function is going to be compared to the data. And then I'm going to arrive to some conclusions. You can go to the next page now. As you all know, the last decade is considered a big success for inflationary cosmology. Well, because for once, the universe appears to be spatially flat. That is, the density appears to be
anyone there? Hello?
Mr. Bob.
Yeah, he's here.
Okay. Can you call Daniel again? We're asking him to connect again.
Okay.
United States 814 Everybody else is online, so we are all staying, but you are listening.
Okay, now are we online?
Yes, we are.
Oh, okay, great. So now I can hear you.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so let me go to number transparency number 4, where I will quickly review what is the standard explanation and show you what are the problems we have with it. Well, in the standard explanation, one starts with the action of a scalar field coupled to gravity in standard form, and then considers a situation which has a background metric, a cosmological Friedmann-Robertson flat spacetime, and considers, for instance, one small perturbation. We will focus here on the scalar perturbation for simplicity. This psi is called the Newtonian potential and represents the main observational part of the data. One, of course, then considers a scalar field that has both a background homogeneous anisotropic component and a perturbation. And in the standard scheme, these perturbations, both the scalar and the scalar field and the Newtonian potential, are intertwined, are mixed. And one introduces a combined field that mixes the matter and gravity perturbation, that's described here by the variable B. This is the famous Mukhanov variable. And after using some of the relations between these two variables that come from the equations of motion and the constraints, one writes one obtains an action for something that looks like a free field with a time dependent mass. After that, one simply selects a vacuum in some reasonable fashion and quantizes this variable. And using then the relations between these between the two variables, one ends up with an expression of this field of the Newtonian potential in terms of this variable, Mukhanov variable, and uses that to compute the two-point correlation function between the variable at different positions and equal cosmological time. That's this function f of x, and from there one obtains a spectrum simply by Fourier transforming that expression. The important point is that this result is essentially independent of k, of the wave number, and that's called the Harrison-Soldovich scale invariant spectrum. Okay, so one is very happy that this spectrum is what one obtain, what one observes. But let's look at this in a little bit more detail. There is something very strange in our understanding of the problem, because the universe, as we have described it in the previous transparency, starts as an homogeneous anisotropic spacetime, basically the Friedmann-Robertson background, and then there is an inflaton field whose space-dependent part is assumed to be in the vacuum, which is, of course, also homogeneous anisotropic.
Then the sorry, you're in slide 5 now, right?
I'm in slide 5, sorry, yes. So the issue is, how do we end up with a situation that is not homogeneous anisotropic, given that the dynamics of the whole system preserves this symmetry? Well, one may be tempted to think that this is just quantum mechanics, but after a little thought, one realizes that this is not exactly the situation, because we want to describe the universe, and the universe is the only real example of a quantum mechanical closed system. So we have not at our, we don't have at our disposal, for example, the orthodox interpretation that requires some external classical measuring apparatus to assume that there is some, you know, breaking of the symmetry associated with our measuring. This is also, this is one of the reasons why, for example, Hartle argues that one needs to generalize quantum theory applicable to make the theory applicable to cosmology. On the other hand, when you talk with most of the experts in the field, they will tell you that there is no problem. When you ask, inquire a little further, you will receive different specific answers from different cosmologies. Something that, of course, reveals that even they have some discomfort with the views of the others. Let's go a little bit more in detail, and let's pass to transparency number 6. The most popular answer to this problem is called the coherence. And the coherence basically starts by describing the system in terms of a reduced density matrix by tracing over some degrees of freedom that one has identified as the environment. That is the density matrix we see in the left. And then after some time averaging, one obtains a diagonal density matrix, because these off-diagonal elements basically average to zero. They oscillate very quickly. And and under certain conditions, one ends up with this sort of diagonal matrix, and that's what the coherence does for you. Of course, the first problem one realizes here is that this diagonal form depends on the choice of basis, because if we change the basis in which we describe the system, the diagonal nature of this matrix will disappear. The answer of the coherence is that the environment system interaction selects the basis. That's fine in most situations, except let's see what can be that environment in the cosmological case. Recall that inflation has removed all matter. In other words, all fields are supposed to be in the vacuum after inflation has done its magic, and has removed therefore all local features. There is nothing. There are no interesting degrees of freedom that one can trace over and say they act like a thermal reservoir or anything like that. The answer will be, in this case, or in most cosmologies, is that, well, there are some degrees of freedom that are unobservable. But what does that mean? It means that we cannot observe them. Okay, that would be fine, except that we are in a cosmological situation where we want to understand. One of the things we want to understand is how we arose from a universe that was initially homogeneous and isotropic, how galaxies evolved, and how we came to be. So it would be circular to use our inabilities to observe some degrees of freedom as part of the explanation of how we came about. Let's go to transparency number 7, please. But even if we find some way to overcome that or accept this problem, let's look at the situation we still face. The coherence has done for you what the green arrow shows. It has transformed your density matrix into a diagonal density matrix. But that, of course, is not what you want, because in our situation, this diagonal density matrix would still be homogeneous and isotropic. The lack of homogeneity will arise only if you imagine that this density matrix represents somehow, tells you somehow that you have to select one of the options that are on the diagonal and believe that that is reality. That's called the problem of definite outcomes, and is marked by this red arrow with the question mark. The problem is then a problem of interpretation. We would like to interpret this basic matrix as representing a choice. That's what we would wish. But that's not what quantum mechanics tells us. What quantum mechanics tells us is that there is a coexistence of all these alternatives. That is what is described by by our state now. Let's go to transparency number 8. Some people believe that the coherence solves the measurement problem in quantum mechanics, but the experts on the field agree that this is not the case. Here I have some quotations from you, but I'm going to go very quickly to them because we lost some time at the beginning. Many theses think the coherence provides a fully satisfactory answer to the measurement problems. This is an illusion. Going more in detail, the formal identification of this reduced density matrix as a mixed state density matrix is easily misinterpreted as implying that the state of the system can be viewed as mixed too. This is false. The total composite system is still described by a superposition, and it follows from the rules of quantum mechanics that no individual definite state can be attributed to any part of the system. If we do that, and compare, for example, with the problem of the EPR, analysis of an EPR type experiment, one arrives to contradictions with experiments. So this is not a legitimate position. Let's go to transparency number 9. There are some other people expressing themselves, but let me just go to the last one, who says that if we are just interested in the predictions about what we shall observe, what will appear to us, and refrain from considering anything as things were before we observed them, then we don't need to invoke any break in the linearity of quantum mechanics, that is, any break in the standard linearity evolution. But precisely this is what we face in cosmology, because we want to talk about the universe as it was before we observed them. We want to explain how we came about. So this standard type of reply that the coherence provides for most situations is not satisfactory in the cosmological setting. Let's pass to transparency number 10, please. Lately, even some of the experts in the field have acknowledged this problem. For example, in the last book, The Physical Foundations of Cosmology by Mukhanov, he states, and let's go to the next transparency. This is a copy of this, a photocopy of this book. It is not a terrible infringement of property rights. But we see, when he considers this question of how does the homogeneity, inhomogeneity that we observe in the universe arise, he states, quantum mechanical linearity evolution does not destroy translational invariance. And he says the coherence may be part of the solution, but then he says, however, the coherence is not sufficient to explain the breaking of translational invariance. And then he says, we have then to appeal to Bohr's reduction postulate, that is collapse of the wave function, or Everett's many word interpretation. He acknowledged then that the first possibility, that is the standard collapse of the wave function upon observation, is not satisfactory in the cosmological setting. And one is left with ever many word interpretation, but once one thinks about it, one realizes that even the many word interpretations faces a completely analogous problems of what as the Bohr reduction postulate. Simply because every time we in the Bohr's interpretation we would be required to say that there is a collapse occurring. In the many word interpretation, we would need to say that there is a branching occurring. And then we have to ask what produces a branching, in the same way that we ask what produces the reduction of the wave function. Other postures that one encounters, let's go to page number 12, is that our universe is not described by quantum mechanics. That the universe was never homogeneous and isotropic, and only certain ensemble of universes was. And it's that ensemble of universes that was described by quantum mechanics. And it's only the superposition of the states of these many universes that is represented by the quantum state that is homogeneous and isotropic. But be careful, this is not quantum mechanics. When we have two or several different systems, the complete system is not described by the superposition of the individual states of the individual systems. That is not quantum mechanics. Another posture one finds is that our universe is still homogeneous and isotropic, and then I don't know what we are talking about, but we can say there are very respected cosmologists that think in this way. Okay.
Another question, can you explain your first point? Why the first point is not quantum mechanics?
Suppose you have two atoms, atom A and atom B, and atom one, and atom A is in state one, and atom B is in state two. The two atoms are not described by the superposition 1 + 2. That's the point. Right? The two atoms will be described by a state in a different Hilbert space, which is the product Hilbert space. And it will be described by a tensor product of 1 + 2, not 1 superposition 2.
Okay.
Okay, so all this is nice philosophy if you want, but I'm going to show you that this is not just philosophy, and that actually the universe offers us a laboratory where some of these issues can be studied. So let's continue. Let's go to page number 13. So what we want in cosmology, a setting that allows us to view quantum mechanics as a theory that describes the system and not just our knowledge about the system, that it provides some historical, that is time development of the description of cosmic evolution that follows the laws of physics. For example, it should be able to assign a quantum state to the system at every time, and we should be able to question at what time the inhomogeneities at one particular scale arose. Such descriptions should explain how did we arise. Of course, the standard story is primordial density fluctuations evolving to galaxies, then stars evolve, planets, living organisms, etc. And therefore, it cannot rely on our measurement inabilities or those of any other late evolved creatures to explain the emergence of the conditions that make them possible. That is, one cannot justify identifying some degrees of freedom as irrelevant environments simply because we cannot observe them now and with our technology, of course. And as I said, it should allow us to consider when the lack of homogeneity and isotropy at any particular scale originates. And it will take the view, of course, standard quantum mechanics doesn't do that for us in this situation, and then we will take the view that the marriage of general relativity and quantum mechanics might involve changes in both in general relativity and in quantum mechanics. If you want, what the view we are taking here is in some sense the opposite direction of most of the research that is done in the field, which is a research that I would characterize as bottom up. You start with what you believe is the fundamental theory, like, let's say, loop quantum gravity or strings or what have you, and then you try to go up and connect to phenomenology and to observations. Here, the view is the opposite. It's to try to push into the understanding of the observations sufficiently down that we may eventually learn something about what is the fundamental theory. Of course, the big goal would be to, you know, meet at some point in the middle. Let me now tell you a little bit of how I see something of this can happen. Let's go to transparency number 14. The quantum, I'm going to see how one connects the fundamental quantum gravity description with an effective description. We all believe that the fundamental theory, or we have very good reasons to believe that the fundamental theory that incorporates quantum gravity and matter field, for instance, should be a temporal theory. For example, loop quantum gravity is an example of such an atemporal theory. States are, you know, there is no time in the state. The states of such theory would be, in general, describable as elements of some, you know, product Hilbert space of gravity and matter or something of that sort. And then the effective description of space-time would be that we need to recover to compare with our world, which requires the identification of some time parameter. Some time parameter that we will use to describe the system in terms of some time evolution. And this time evolution would emerge in this scheme as the result of correlations between the degrees of freedom in the fundamental theory. For example, as is done in recent works in loop quantum cosmology. But we know, or we believe, or it's pretty convincing, that such an effective evolution is not necessarily completely unitary. For example, Gambini, Portland Pooling has done some recent work. Here I cite one of the first of those, in which they show that under certain conditions, realistic clock evolution that is described in terms of realistic clocks is not unitary. more generally, I don't see any impediment for there to be jumps or discontinuities in these correlations, so there could be something like jumps in the effective description that we will obtain from that fundamental theory. Then we know, of course, that in situations that are sufficiently close to classical, the effective evolution should take the form of something like semi-classical gravity coupled to quantum fields. And perhaps there will be some small modifications that have information about, you know, the details of this fundamental theory. This is the view that we are taking in this work. But then we are going to try to guess what is what are those changes? And let's go to transparency 15. So, as we have argued, the standard scheme was not sufficient, it was not satisfactory, had some serious problems, and when we would try to amend it by introducing some minimal set of additional assumptions, we will then follow some generic ideas of Penrose and say that the fundamental theory that describes gravity is in terms of some more fundamental degrees of freedom than the metric variables, as, for example, the quantum gravity or even string theory. And the metric description is just an effective one. Moreover, quantum mechanics is incomplete. Why? Because quantum mechanics needs to be amended with a type of self-induced collapse of the wave function. And why collapse? Collapse is the only known mechanism that is capable from taking a symmetric state into an asymmetric state when the dynamics preserve the symmetry. Right? You can have something that is symmetric under space reflection, and then we know that upon measurement, the spin will not necessarily be symmetric. But of course, the measurement involves interaction with the external object. Here, the idea is that the collapse is self-induced or induced by a combination of quantum of the quantum gravity degrees of freedom with the matter degrees of freedom, or something of that sort. So this is the new ingredient that is brought into physics by the marriage of quantum and gravity. It's going to be described effectively in terms of a self-induced collapse that does not require an external agent to produce it. Okay, now I should hurry a little bit. Okay, so how do we do this? Well, we will then write the semi-classical Einstein equation and add a little a small correction, QAB, that whose role here will be to compensate for the jump of the state that is described in the next line. We will assume that the state of the matter, which is the only part that is described at the completely quantum language in this equation, is subject to this type of jumps. Besides its unitary evolution, sometimes it undergoes this quantum collapse. And this QAB is placed there just to make the equation self-consistent when these jumps occur. The idea is that in the situation we are describing, these quantum gravity degrees of freedom are not excited except at the jumps, and then is when this QAB reacts to this matter, the jumps in the quantum state of the matter. We will assume that then, therefore, that this QAB vanishes both before and after the collapse has occurred, and therefore, in the periods in between the collapses, what we have is the standard semi-classical equation. And what we want to do is to extract some characteristics of this new physics from the observation. So let's see how we do that. Let's go to transparency number 17. Okay, now we proceed to treat the same system as before, a universe, which is just flat Robertson-Walker universe with a perturbation, which is the Newtonian potential as before, which could be zero or not, depending on the situation. And we will assume that it's zero at the beginning, when before the collapses have occurred. Then there is a scalar field. It has, of course, the time-independent, the homogeneous anisotropic part and a quantum and a fluctuating part, or let's say the quantum, fully quantum part. And then it's convenient to introduce a rescale field. It's a simple rescaling of this field by the scale parameter. And then we consider also its conjugate momentum. Look, notice that in this scheme we are only treating at the in the quantum language the matter fields, and the scalar and the metric variables are still described classically. Einstein equations then leads us to this expression for that connects the Newtonian potential to the quantum field, the momentum conjugate actually, and there is a coupling parameter, which is basically Newton's constant times the time derivative of the background Newton field. One quantizes this field, one can put it in a box if one wants, in the standard way, looks for a vacuum and has a quantum theory of the field. Now, the semi-classical version of this equation, which is what was a call going to use, corresponding to the semi-classical Einstein equation, takes this form, where we see that the metric variable is connected to the expectation value of the quantum field, or the quantum momentum conjugate. Going to a periodic position allows us to write the k component of the Newtonian potential, again in terms of the expectation value of the k component of the momentum conjugate, and this is generic for any state of the quantum field. Of course, when we start, we are in the vacuum state, so let's go to transparency number 18. And in the quantum state, in the vacuum state, both the field and its momentum conjugate have zero expectation value, and therefore, before the collapse, the Newtonian potential is exactly zero, and our universe is homogeneous and isotropic. Now, as we said, we will assume that at certain times the modes collapse, the states collapse, and we will assume that the mode K collapses at the time eta K of collapse. Eta of collapse of the mode K. And how does this collapse occur? Well, we have to make guess. So one of the schemes, call it the symmetric scheme, which is more in detail, simply assumes that after the collapse, the state here in the right hand, in the left hand side, we see the expectation value of the field and momentum conjugate after the collapse has occurred. And we will assume this is a random number times the uncertainty of the corresponding variables in the previous state, which was the vacuum. So this allows us to write these expectation values in terms of random, some aleatory numbers and known quantities. Let's go now to transparency number 19.
Daniel, before you go there, you had an early transparency in which you had this variable Q, which you introduced in order to have consistency.
Yes.
And that Q was excited just during the collapse, and so, I mean, during the, yeah, collapse, basically.
Right.
But then when you look at the perfect equation, it seems that Q just disappeared.
Right.
And
I was going to assume that Q, either before the collapse or after the collapse, has vanished, and it only has non-zero value during the collapse. And I'm only looking here at what was before the collapse and after the collapse. I'm not yet studying what happened during the collapse.
Okay, thank you.
So, well, there are other schemes. I'm going to go very quickly to them. There are other possibilities, but just one of the variables collapses. It's called the gravity coupling preferred. And there is another one suggested by a colleague in Spain, Jaume Garriaga, which is called a Wigner functional tracker. Basically, it collapses using maintaining the correlations, certain degree of correlation between the variables in the pre-existing state. Let me go quickly to them. And let's go now to transparency number 20. Okay, in any of these cases, after the collapse, the expectation value of the momentum conjugate to the field is different from zero, and therefore the metric variable, the Hamiltonian potential, the component is also different from zero, and it's at this point, after that collapse of that mode has occurred, that the universe has become anisotropic and inhomogeneous at that particular scale. Now we want to compare with data. To compare with data, we need two pieces of information. I need to tell you which one of the schemes of collapse I will use, and what is the value of the time of collapse for the different modes. Let's go to transparency number 21. Once we have the expression for the scale component of the Newtonian potential, I can reconstruct the Newtonian potential at any time. It's going to be jumping around. This Newtonian potential at the time of the coupling is what determines the variation of temperature with angle, or the variations of temperature over the surface of last scattering, simply because, you know, the photons that emerge from potential wells will have bigger redshift. There is also, I'm going to incorporate here, an effect that is the effect of the latent physics associated with plasma oscillations and things like that, that we believe we understand. Of course, in order to do actual comparisons, one would need to pull it there. I'm going to assume that this is one for most of the rest of the talk. Basically, what I'm saying is I'm going to ignore the acoustic oscillations in analyzing the data.
Daniel, sorry, I'm lost on the new notation. Can you explain what is UF in terms of the previous things you use?
Yes, okay. Here, phi is the Newtonian potential at the conformal time eta and position x. Okay? Then we have an expression that is the only quantity that I need to tell you about are this U function and the F function. The rest are the variables that I have, you know, the size of my box, that was just artificial thing, the wave number, the size of the universe, things of that form. This U variable is called the transfer function. It tells you how the oscillations at the are amplified or reduced due to plasma. This F of k contains information about the post-collapse state, how the state collapsed, the state k, how the mode k collapsed. And it's encoded there. I'm sorry, I cannot do the calculation here because of lack of time. But then I have this expression. It's okay?
Okay. So F is related to this X, R that you had before, or?
Yeah, F is related to the square of this, well, it's related to the variables that I had before telling you the time of collapse, for example. We will see something about it in a moment.
Okay. But also an implicit assumption is that the collapse occurs instantaneously everywhere in this world.
Right. No, that's true. Each mode collapses. Yes. The implicit assumption is that each mode collapses on its own.
Right. But each mode collapses all over the universe at once.
Right. That's true.
So is your, I mean, maybe I'm running ahead, but is your viewpoint that you are doing it this just a simplicity that realistically this would not happen. Yeah, that's your viewpoint.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, now the quantity of interest is the convolution of this Newtonian potential on the surface of glass scattering with an harmonic spheric, which is this quantity alpha Ln, which is what we see in the sky. Of course, after the identification of what we see is the variation of temperature with temperature, but sorry, the variation of temperature on the sky, but that, as I said, is associated with the gravitational redshift produced by the Newtonian potential at the time of glass scattering. Well, I have then an expression for this variable alpha Ln, which is a complicated expression. It doesn't matter. It contains, you know, all these things that we have put before. But the only thing I want you to notice here is that there is a summatory over k. There is a summatory over k, and then there is this function fk inside. And each one of these functions fk contains some aleatory numbers, those x's that I introduced before. And what it tells me is that this alpha Ln is in some sense given by a sort of random walk. But there are random numbers in each one of the FKs, and each one of the steps of the random walk has a characteristic size given by the steps of the dependence on K. The point, of course, is that for a random walk, I cannot predict the position after a random walk. The only thing I can predict is the most likely value. And that's what we compute. The most likely value of the magnitude of this random walk, that is the quantity alpha Lm squared most likely value. That's the last thing in the transparency. Let's go now to transparency number, the next transparency, sorry.
Okay, so this property of S, that the result is just a random walk, is this for scheme 1, or is this something that is true more generally?
In all the schemes, there is a random walk, yes.
All the schemes that you're
talking about. The size of the steps is different in the different random walks. Okay, one can compute this quantity taking the limit of the box goes to infinity, and one ends up with an expression that contains a Bessel function. It contains two functions here, this function u, the transfer function, and this function c. This function C contains information of the square about the square of this function F, and is therefore related to this mode of collapse. Here, this variable R sub B is the radius of the surface of glass scattering. In the scale invariant situation, the scale invariant spectrum is called scale invariant in part because normally the quantity Rd will disappear from these expressions. If the denominator mu, which is a parameter of slow roll, is zero, and these functions c would be constant, and the function u would be constant, this quantity will be independent of the size of the surface of glass scattering. And that's what one would predict for a flat spectrum. Of course, that's not the case, in particular because this function u contains information about the latent physics, which has some characteristic scales associated with the plasma oscillation. And that's where the dependence on the size of the surface of glass scattering normally arises. That could be an extra dependence associated with the lack deviation from slow rolling, but we have an extra dependence here associated with the function C that contains information of the collapse. In the scheme 1, one can compute this form of the function C, and it's this expression here, relatively, well, mildly complicated expression, that depends very strongly on this variable ck. This variable ck is the product of the time of collapse of mode k times the variable k. Okay? So in order to recover the standard the standard type of spectrum, one would need ck to be independent of k, and then we would, you know, just have the standard type of analysis. And if that, but for that to happen, we would need ck to be independent of k. That means ck equal a constant for all k. So that's the first thing we learned, that in order to recover a standard spectrum, one needs a time of collapse of the mode k to be inversely proportional to the wave number. But let's go a little bit more farther ahead. Sorry, I'm running out of time. Well, you have 10 more minutes or something like that? Let's go to transparency number 23.
So can I ask a question there? It's related to the question that Abhay asked before. So
yes.
In your model of collapse, I try to understand, you have each mode collapse at a given time, LC.
Yes.
But it means that there is a collapse occurring all the time.
Yes.
So now, because there is a collapse occurring all the time, you cannot really use Einstein equation to use the... because you wanted to use Einstein equation away from the time of collapse.
Yeah, but I have separated the Einstein equation for each mode. And each mode collapses at different times.
Okay, so for each mode, you do that.
So for each mode, I can do it.
Okay.
Daniel, you have 15 more minutes at least, and then we still will have about 10 more minutes for discussion.
Oh, excellent. Sorry, I'm sorry about the beginning of this problem.
Yeah, that's why we're
okay. Okay, thank you very much. So let's continue to the next transparency. Many people wonder about this oscillation behavior of this function CK. And in some sense, it's relatively easy to understand realistically. Basically, let's look at the mode of each mode K of the inflaton field is essentially an harmonic oscillator. And it's supposed to be in the ground state of this harmonic oscillator corresponding to the vacuum of the field. Initially, the state is that. After the collapse, the state of that mode is assumed to be represented by this second wave packet that is concentrated and displaced from the original position. But we know that if one puts an harmonic oscillator in this type of coherent state, it will oscillate in time. And when these oscillations transfer into the spectrum, will produce this type of oscillatory behavior in the function that is represented by the function CK. That's why the sinus cosines appear in this function. Okay? Well, all these calculations are done in detail in the paper, but of course you cannot put this in here. Let's go to transparency number 24. The interesting thing, of course, for me, the most interesting thing is that one now can compare with actual data. For example, if I assume, in contrast with what I told you before, that the mode of the collapse occurs not at differential times for the different modes, but let's say all modes collapse at a certain particular time. So eta k is constant. And I use then the corresponding spectrum. I obtain these wiggly lines that I observe here, which can be contrasted with the little crosses on the figure, which are the experimental data. So if you want, this shows that the assumption that the collapse occurs at a single instant in time can be ruled out by experiment, at least for these values that I have been considering in this simulation. Okay, so we can take these ideas and test them. Let's go to the next transparency. This, of course, here I have added in the simulation. We have my colleagues have added in the simulation the actual plasma the effects of plasma oscillations on top of the spectrum, because only then can I compare really directly with data like we are doing here. Let's go to the next transparency. Similarly, the power spectrum of the large-scale matter distribution can be compared with the predictions, and we see here a smooth curve, which is basically what the standard scenarios would produce, and a very wiggly curve that probably can be ruled out by comparing with data. I don't know the details of this, how is the experimental situation here, but of course it's different from the standard prediction. We see these peaks associated with these extra oscillations that we saw in the previous transparency. Let's go now to the next transparency, where we have expressions for the functions C of the other two schemes. Scheme number two has a relatively similar behavior. It's not exactly the same. Scheme three is the one that tracks the Wigner functional. It's much more complicated. But we see in all of them a strong dependence on the variable CK. Let's look at the next transparency where we see a graph. This is very difficult to see what these functions look like. Graph them. I don't know if you can see, there are three graphs here for the different behaviors of the functions CK, which shows that the different scheme of collapse produce different, you know, modifications of the spectrum. Now, I would like to use this to compare with observations, and I remind you that besides selecting the scheme of collapse, I have to tell you what is the time of collapse of each mode, or in other words, I have to tell you what is the function C of K. Let's go to the next transparency. This, by the way, is done by my student Adolfo de Manuel. Let's go to the next transparency, where we can do some early steps in the phenomenological analysis. We want to compare the different collapse schemes and various possibilities of collapse times, and eventually perhaps other parameters. And as I said, if we assume that the time of collapse of mode K is inversely proportional to K, we recover the standard form of the spectrum. Therefore, we will assume that there is a small deviation from that, that the time of collapse goes like A over K plus some constant, and we'll try to obtain some... Sorry? Hello?
Hello?
Yes?
This is Marseille?
Yeah, you're on, Carlo.
I don't know what's happening. I'm giving this talk in international...
Yeah, that's Carlo Rovelli.
I'm sorry. I'm late. I shut up.
That's okay. Here we go. Yeah, you are an hour late, I think.
Am I?
Yeah, we started almost an hour. Yeah, an hour early.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Okay. Sorry. I'll shut up in any case.
All right. Okay. So we will try to put some bounds on A and B. Let's see how that is. What are the first steps? We haven't finished. This is work in progress, but I want to show you that things can be done. Let's go to the next transparency. The first thing we did is forget about this transfer function. In other words, assume that we could ignore the effects of plasma oscillations and actually erase them from the spectrum. Under those conditions, if you remember one, probably my second or third transparency, we show that the standard prediction of inflation is a flat spectrum and that the oscillations are associated with plasma peaking. So if we ignore those oscillations, if you go to page number 3, I think, if you ignore those oscillations, you would get a straight line for the form of the spectrum. So that's what we would try to compare with. So let's go to transparency number 29, where that is done. So we here see for different values of A and B, the forms of the spectrum that would normally be, that would in the standard scenario be just flat. We see that there are some that look very flat and others that look rather different with different type of oscillatory-like behavior. Here, the graph is plotted until L2 of the order of 1,000, which is what we are starting to observe these days. I think the latest observations are can look at Ls of the order of 800 or 900 or so. So these deviations would be within, or some of these, the most dramatic, would say the red one, the top one, would be within the range of things that we are actually observing these days. And one would be able, for example, to discard these values of A and B that are represented by the red graph. The other, this is in scheme one. Scheme two produces a slightly different picture. That's shown in page number 30. To page number 30. Here the scheme produces, the difference is that in this scheme things tend to decrease at large L rather than increase. There is an initial decrease in the spectrum and then a small rebound for certain values that we can see in one of the, let's say, the pink line. Also, changes within the observational regime. Many of these would be some of them would be discarded when one compares with more detail, in more detail with experiment. Let's go to transparency number 31, where we see another scheme in 3, very similar to the previous one. And now let's pass to the next transparency, please, number 32. What I wanted to show here was that the different schemes can be differentiated. Let's go to number 32, sorry. Here, with his colleagues from Argentina, we have actually combined the effects of the change in the spectrum associated with the collapse with the plasma oscillation, so this can be directly compared with experiment. Here we see three values of the for the parameters, fixing the parameter A and changing the parameter B. We change the form of the spectrum, and this data can be compared directly with experiment now, because this has, you know, all the physics input that needs to be brought to bear. So some of these graphs would be able to, we will rule out by comparing with experiment. For example, if the first peak becomes too big due to our correction, then that could be perhaps ruled out. This is work in progress, it's a preliminary data. Let's look at the next transparency. Also, in the power spectrum, we see small changes, less drastic than the previous ones. Remember, I showed you a graph in which we have assumed that the time of collapse is constant and it was very dramatic changes. Here we see changes that are more subtle. But the point is that they exist and we can compare them with observation. Let's now pass to the next transparency, please.
Daniel, you only have about 5 minutes in case you want
to. 5 minutes, okay. So let me just show you that we can use this approach to test some ideas. As you know, probably Penrose has proposed a scheme of collapse in which he says that quantum coexisting alternatives would be interacting through some kind of a gravitational, would be characterized by some gravitational interaction between the two alternatives. And when the level of this gravitational interaction reaches the Planck mass, the collapse will occur. That is the scheme that Penrose has proposed, and I have even proposed some experiments to do that. Well, we can test this idea or a generalization of this idea in the cosmological setting relatively easy. Let's go to transparency number 35, where we have an expression for the energy of interaction between two alternatives. That is the assumption that the collapse occurs in one direction in one alternative, and the collapse occurs in the second direction in the second alternative, and we compute the Newtonian potential of the first alternative and the matter energy density of the second alternative, and this integral, of course, is the energy of interaction between the two alternatives. And for individual modes, this thing can be computed explicitly and has this form, assuming that the collapse occurs this is characterized by this and should be multiplied by this, the magnitude of this random variable that was between 0 and 1. So this is not exact, but almost. Okay. I mean, it has some random variation there also. But the generic value is this quantity, and then we assume that the collapse will occur when this quantity reaches the Planck mass. And from there, one can obtain, let's go to transparency 36, an expression for the time at which that energy reaches the Planck energy. And we see that the prediction is exactly as the form C over K, with C a quantity that is given in terms of the inflationary parameters. But the point is that this independent of K as required for the spectrum to fit the standard type of spectrum. So in other words, the Penrose scheme appears to pass this test of predicting a collapse that occurs according to the time. times required for it to reproduce the standard inflationary type of prediction.
Why is that integral not just infinite? Because you are integrating
on all. If you add over all the modes, it's infinite. But for each mode, it's not infinite. It's just like computing the energy of a harmonic, of a state of the field.
But even for one more, right? It's all spread on all space, right?
Right, but that's the same for if you have a standard quantum field excited in one particle, one mode with number k, your energy is omega k times h, even though the mode is spread all over the world.
Okay,
got it. But it's the standard thing. Of course, if you add over all the k's, then the thing would diverge. Well, in our case, we can actually compute when do the relevant modes collapse, and for the standard values of the deflationary parameters, it turns out to be around 80 EFOs before the end of inflation. Actually, one can compute the relative size of the scale parameter at the time of collapse of the mode K to the time of horizon exit of that same mode, and it's an expression that is given here. For the standard numbers, this is a very large number, so the collapse occurred long after horizon exit of the corresponding mode. Let's keep going. I think I'm basically done. Question number 37. So these are the conclusions. The conclusions, the very strong conclusion is that there is something related to quantum mechanics that is missing in our understanding of the origin of cosmic structure, and there is something like a self-induced collapse is what seems to be required to take us from something that is homogeneous and isotropic to something that is not. This proposal has the required features. It's a phenomenological proposal. It does not pretend to be a fundamental theory of quantum gravity. As I said, it's a top-down approach. It leads to phenomenological predictions that can be compared, and hopefully one can extract information about what is the fundamental theory or what is the connection between this theory and the fundamental theory from observations. It has some other advantages. It turns out, without our willing to obtain that, it alleviates the need for fine-tuning that afflicts most of the inflationary scenarios. And in this scheme in particular, there is a strong prediction that there would be no tensor modes, because as you saw, gravity was not quantized at the same level or in the same way as gravity was quantized, as matter was quantized. And for the tensor modes, matter does not offer a source of the same intensity as for the scalar mode. And this can, of course, be looked for in the CMB anisotropies. And actually, the experiments that are proposed for the near future are going to look for these modes intensively. So my conclusion is that new physics seems to be there. The observations we have cannot be satisfactorily explained, and we should start exploring it. And we are taking the first steps in that direction. So thank you very much.
Questions?
It's Laurent from PI. I have a question.
Hello.
Concerning this notion of collapse, because I'm not sure. So in the model you're looking at, I was wondering if in fact what you're describing might be valid also for non-collapse model. So let me explain. What you're looking at is semi-classical gravity, right? So you look the T mu nu is equal to the expectation value, G mu is equal to the expectation value of T mu nu. And we know that this is, kind of valid as long as the state in which you evaluate T mu nu doesn't evolve. But even in a theory of quantum gravity, there will be maybe some back reaction and the state will evolve. So what you call a collapse, can't it be in a model of quantum gravity just the fact that the state evolves in a particular manner? And, you work in the context of semi-classical gravity, but do you really need some collapse model or is this just some extension of semi-classical gravity?
Let me tell you something. If we only take the state of the field to evolve, which we actually take it to evolve, I don't have a problem with evolving. that if it just evolves according to the unitary evolution provided by the dynamics of the field, then if the situation, initial situation was homogeneous or isentropic, your state after evolution would still be homogeneous and isentropic. And then the expectation value of the energy momentum tensor would be homogeneous and isentropic, and there would be no Newtonian potential. Okay?
Okay.
So you need...
Are you sure? Is there any way people can do this computation, Congress?
I'm sure. It's just... This is automatic.
The source would be...
The Hamiltonian of evolution commutes with the translation operator on each of the slices of your field, of your space-time.
Yeah, but the state can be...
If the state was inhomogeneous at the beginning, if the state is homogeneous at the beginning, it will be translationally invariant. And translation commutes with the Hamiltonian of evolution. So even though I cannot show you explicitly this evolution, I can assure you that the state will be translationally invariant, because just simply by commuting the operators.
So you're saying in quantum gravity, any evolution that I will have there, if I go to this semi-classical regime, what will be the property of this evolution?
Well, in quantum gravity, as far as I understand, we don't know what is evolution, because we don't have time, for example, in loop quantum gravity or things like that.
No, but here you're going to a semi-classical regime. So where
In the semi-classical regime, it will, if you start with a state that is homogeneous, then it's going to be homogeneous for the rest of time.
Mm.
If the dynamics preserve the homogeneity. Imagine I give you an harmonic oscillator, and I tell you I'm going to change it to be anharmonic, complicated way, but I'm going to start from the ground state, which is symmetric until x goes to minus x, and the change in the potential is going to preserve the symmetry. Then the state is going to be extremely complicated, but it's going to be symmetric.
Yeah. So what if the initial state is not totally symmetric?
Then that's fine, but then it means that you put the inhomogeneities and anisotropies from the beginning, and you cannot say that you can explain them.
Okay.
So, I agree completely with the explanation that Daniel just gave. I'm very sympathetic, as you know, Daniel, about this idea about bringing in some mechanism like the collapse and such thing in order to go from the homogeneity and isotropy to breaking it. I mean, one needs something like that, it's clear. I mean, I've been not so comfortable with this precise mechanism, like, you know, I think answer 19, you know, when you write down the scheme, specific scheme. Right? Again, I don't, I guess 18 or 19. So I agree that, you know, one has to start somewhere and one should do that. But basically what you're saying is that there is, for each board, there is some dispersion, and the collapse just takes this, the value of pi and the value of the field y from the initial value 0 to some value within this dispersion, and then there are these random number of x's which are there, and we don't know what these x's are, basically.
Right.
So, I mean, of course, one has to start somewhere, and it's great to start like that and then compare with the data and then put limits on these and narrow down the choices. But one could also start thinking now that you have done so much other work, about whether one can justify something like this from more fundamental principles.
And
already in your earlier transparencies, you sort of pointed out that indeed,
in loop quantum cosmology, for example, there is an external time. But also it is now known that if you try to go to quantum field theory in curved space-time, there really is an approximation involved. And there is no there's an issue about matching quantum geometry coming from quantum cosmology with quantum field theory on the classical geometry that cosmologists use. And there really is a gap there. And is also related to the work of Pullin and Gambini that you sort of mentioned. So my question is really, are there, you or anybody else, do you have any thoughts about using the Gambini-Pullin type work in order to get some insight or get a little better, little more fundamental understanding of the collapse mechanism?
first of all, I sympathize with everything you said, and I'm all in favor of looking for that mechanism. I'm not proficient enough on any loop quantum gravity or any of the other things to try to attempt it myself. But my approach, but I think that would be a complementary approach. That would be a bottom-up approach, starting from what you believe to be a fundamental theory and trying to connect here. What I see this work doing is going in the opposite direction, going from bottom-up, trying to, and of course it would be great to meet somebody in the middle and have a complete connection from some fundamental theory to all the way to observations.
Right.
I agree with you that this is needed.
No, okay. My question was only because I've not followed this in detail, and I just wanted to know if other people were looking at it. And you are saying that, well, no. I mean, we have to. There's work to be done. One has to meet the two approaches that you need somewhere.
Yes, that's what.
I got one other question, which is really this. Maybe it's a secondary question. This is really going back to your Transparency 7 about your criticisms of decoherence.
Okay, let me go. Transparency 7.
You want to say that there's a problem with this. How can it be? You want to say that in this green arrow, one still kept homogeneity and isotropy.
Right.
Is that not obvious to me? I mean, won't it depend on what I trace over?
Well, it's in general also homogeneous and isotropic in the standard ways people have tried to do it. For
right.
example, if you want to trace over some degrees of freedom. In some analysis done, for example, by Starobinsky, he identified that for each mode, there are two types for each K, there are two modes. One that increases or and then flattens out, and one that decreases very quickly to zero. Then, he argues that one should trace over this degree of freedom because it goes to zero, and when you trace, you end up with a density matrix.
But
you see, this tracing has not broken the invariant.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you end up with something invariant. So if you start with something that is invariant, and you look for things that you can trace over, those are going to be invariant as well because there is nothing in the scheme that is going to select for you a preferred point or direction, and then if you follow your nose and undo that, you end up with a density matrix for this also.
Right. So, but just as you had a new postulate, one could have a new postulate which says that one is tracing over. I'm not just saying it out of the blue, but one is tracing over some degrees of freedom, and those have to be chosen appropriately, and then of course one would have to, justify this from more fundamental principles. But then those you just choose appropriately in order that after tracing, the density matrix has lost the complete homogeneity and isotropy.
Right.
That, in principle, is not impossible.
No, it's not impossible. It's not impossible, but you need a criteria that, you see that the breaking of the homogeneity would occur when you put this criteria in. Right? By you're putting the criteria that you are breaking this homogeneity. So your criteria would have to find something inhomogeneous.
I agree. But I mean, one could just do this just like the way that you did it, right? I mean, you just have a phenomenological criteria and put some parameters, the phenomenological criteria of how much of homogeneity and isotropy you break. And then you test with experiments and observations.
Right.
One could do that also, rather than coming down from fundamental theory and say why one is facing over what one is facing over.
Yeah, one could. I'm not saying that this approach is unique or anything like that. I'm not claiming that this is unique. I'm claiming that this is an approach that pretends to answer a question that is left unanswered.
I mean, your last thing about the Salmon-Perez result was very, very interesting. But on the other hand, I'm still not understanding why one has to look at it one more at a time.
That's an excellent question. That's an excellent question, and I don't have an answer.
Yes, okay.
Any other questions here?
Okay, where does it stand state? Perimeter or Marseille?
Sorry?
Any questions are finished. Any other questions?
Okay. Yeah, so if there are no more questions, we'll thank the speaker. But before that, I want to remind people that the next date, 2 weeks from now, is still open. So volunteers are welcome. So let's thank Daniel.
Okay. Thank you very much.